right, good evening. This is Bio 241. It's November 13th, and we're going to finish up endocrine system and move on to muscles tonight. And let's see, next week, we got to have a test. Okay? The drop date is the 22nd. I think that's either Friday or Saturday, something like that. I think it's Saturday. So we're not going to have the test on Tuesday. We'll have it on Thursday. And it's going to cover through muscles. Okay, so we got to get through muscles tonight and on Tuesday. So that's what you need to look for over the weekend. So let's finish up with endocrine system. All right, this last part is kind of a review from lab, but we're going to talk about the pancreas. And the pancreas is an interesting organ because it is part endocrine and part exocrine gland. So let's make sure that we understand what those terminologies mean. What is an endocrine gland? What's an endocrine gland? It's a ductless gland. And an exocrine gland? It secretes something where? An exocrine gland? Okay, so an endocrine gland, in the way that I think, secretes something into the blood. And an exocrine gland secretes something into a duct that carries it someplace. All right? And so we're going to look at the endocrine part of the pancreas, but when you look at the pancreas, you see a duct right here. So that means that the pancreas also has an exocrine function as well. All right? But we're not going to be studying that this time. Maybe when we get to the digestive system, we'll come back and take a look at the pancreas. All right, so here is just a review from anatomy. Here's the tail of the pancreas. Here's the head. This is the pancreatic duct. And indeed, the pancreas does synthesize and secrete digestive enzymes or precursors to digestive enzymes that go through the pancreatic duct into the duodenum, as well as compounds that neutralize stomach acids that come into the small intestine. All right, but that's not really what we're interested in because we're talking endocrinology. The hormones that are secreted by the pancreas are insulin and glucagon. And they're secreted by the islets of Langerhans. So here is a little islet. It's just a little group of cells. And when these cells secrete insulin and glucagon, they're not secreted into the pancreatic duct. They're just secreted into the interstitial space, and they're picked up by capillaries within the pancreas, which then distribute insulin and glucagon all over the body. So the two kinds of cells that we have in here are alpha cells and beta cells. And the alpha cells secrete which hormone? That would be glucagon. And the beta cells secrete insulin. And these hormones have antagonistic actions to each other in terms of blood glucose, regulating blood glucose concentration. So just like the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, this is nice antagonistic control. Which one raises blood glucose? Glucagon. Okay, do you know the mechanism of action by which glucagon works? Glycogenolysis. That's right, glycogenolysis and also lipolysis, but glycogenolysis I would like for you to have on the tip of your tongue. And the beta cells secrete insulin. What's the effect on blood glucose when insulin is secreted? Okay, it causes blood sugar to do what? Go up or down? Go down, that's right. So glucose is going to be absorbed by cells. And that glucose then can be incorporated into glycogen. So we call that what? Glycogenesis is going to be stimulated. And if it's an adipose cell, then that glucose can be used to make fat. Okay, so the ducts are not necessary for insulin and glucagon. All right, so the alpha secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. So the alpha cells have glucose chemoreceptors, and those alpha cells can tell what the blood glucose is. And if it's too low, that stimulates glycogenolysis and lipolysis, which increases blood glucose. And when blood glucose reaches the normal concentration, then the islets of Langerhans stop secreting glucagon. So the response is going to subtract from the stimulus. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining homeostasis. Okay. Insulin is secreted by the beta cells in response to high blood glucose. So the beta cells have glucose chemoreceptors. And don't forget that in order for glucose to enter cells, it needs a passport. And insulin acts as that passport. So why is it that glucose cannot enter a cell? with some basic physical chemistry of a glucose molecule. It is hydro. Yeah, because if you take glucose and put it in your coffee, it's going to dissolve right away, right? So it's hydrophilic. But remember, the membrane, cell membrane, is hydrophobic, and so these hydrophilic molecules can't diffuse through cell membrane. And what insulin does is that it provides for the insertion of GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane, which then allows for the passive diffusion or facilitated diffusion of glucose into the cell. And when glucose leaves the blood and goes into the cell, blood glucose concentration decreases. So insulin promotes entry of glucose into cells, and when it's inside the cell, glucose can be converted to glycogen, or if it's an adipose cell, it can be converted into fat for storage. So glycogen is a more direct storage form of glucose, and fat is not a storage form of glucose, but it is a storage form of energy. All right, so you can't convert fat back into glucose, but it can be used to generate ATP. And when that happens, that decreases blood glucose. So let's start with a response loop. If you have increasing blood glucose, what's going to be stimulated, the alpha cells or beta cells? Beta cells. All right, when blood glucose increases, that's going to stimulate the beta cells. All right, and those are in the islets of Langerhans. And the beta cells then will secrete insulin. So that's going to bind to what, a tyrosine kinase receptor. It's going to phosphorylate some tyrosine residues and some regulatory proteins inside the cell, and it's going to cause the fusion of those endosomes that contain the GLUT4 transporters into the membrane, and glucose can start to diffuse into a cell. And so we call that cellular uptake. So insulin, by that mechanism, increases cellular uptake of glucose. So the response then to blood glucose is what? To decrease it, because it's got to come from someplace. It comes from blood, it goes down. So this is the response. It subtracts from the stimulus, right? So that's nice negative feedback that maintains blood glucose levels within that homeostatic range. All right, and when cells take up glucose, it can be converted into glycogen in liver and skeletal muscle. And what process is that again called? That is glycogenesis, that's the making of glycogen, or glucose and adipose tissue is going to be used to make triglycerides. Okay, that's lipogenesis. I don't think you had to know that one. And then that energy is stored in those adipocytes until we start starving to death. All right, so that's insulin and glucagon, and you should appreciate the nice antagonistic mechanism that they have with respect to each other, okay? And the alpha and beta cells. And probably you got to know everything else about insulin and diabetes. Probably the two kinds of diabetes. Diabetes 1, due to the pancreas not making insulin, and diabetes type 2, the pancreas makes normal levels of insulin or maybe even elevated, but the receptor is malfunctioning so that the GLUT4 transporters are not put into the membrane. Okay, and I think the only other thing that I'm going to mention real quickly in terms of this chapter right here is the pineal gland secretes melatonin, which regulates circadian rhythms in people, which are the day-night cycles, sleep cycles, wake cycles. All right, so the suprachiasmatic nucleus is the primary timing center for circadian rhythms in people, and it is set by the daily light-dark cycles that people observe with their eyes. Okay, and melatonin is secreted at night, and it is inhibited at light, and it inhibits GnRH. It's an anti-gonadotropic stimulus in many animals. So in humans, our reproductive cycle does not change over the course of a year, but in many animals it does. It is seasonal. Can anybody give me the name of an animal where reproductive behavior is seasonal, for instance? Bears, did you say? Absolutely. Okay. And most wild birds, right? Unless they maybe, well, even if they stay in this part of the world, right, if they don't migrate, they're still very sensitive to photoperiod. And when do they have young? In springtime, right, when the photoperiods start to get long. And that's mediated by the pineal gland and melatonin. All right, so you know what? That's all we're going to talk about. I just will mention, though, that the thymus gland, which is in the mediastinum right here, secretes thymusin, and this helps the maturation of certain kinds of lymphocytes that fight infections in our body, the T lymphocytes. Okay, so the thymus is responsible for the maturation of T cells of the immune system and the hormones that stimulate that process, namely thymusin. And T cells are contact killer cells. They don't secrete antibodies, but they're contact killers. So when a T cell bumps into a bacteria, it will bind to that bacteria and cause that bacteria to lyse, which means what? Basically break up, right? And then that kills the bacteria. Okay. We're not going to talk about these hormones unless we get to the reproductive system, but you should at least be aware of some sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone, which control reproductive behavior and cycles. And the placenta also secretes estrogen and progesterone, human chorionic gonadotropin, and somatomammotropin. So we might talk about these later on in the class, so it's okay if you hear a little bit about them now. But that's it for this particular chapter. Okay. Yeah, not unless you have a question in the back of the book or something. And none of these are exam figures, so. I'm not going to generate any questions on these unless there is a specific question on the web or something, or the back of the book that I've assigned you. I can't remember if I have. I don't think I have. But just in case if I did, yeah, you should definitely not ignore any that I have on your study guide. Okay? Okay. If you have a question, I'll be happy to answer them on Tuesday. Okay. So it's pretty easy stuff to try to figure out. All right, so we're going to move on to muscle. And so what are the four kinds of tissues in the body, once again? Some are four kinds of tissues, overall tissues. What kind of tissues we have in the body? Skeletal? No, that's not a tissue. Oh, I'm glad I'm asking. Okay, four general kinds of tissues, and then maybe some subclasses. If I point to some place on your body, you could tell me exactly one of four different kinds of tissues.
Connective.
Like right here. What here?
Connective.
Oh, you're good. Epithelium is one. Okay. Connective tissue is another. What's another? You maybe said, but I didn't quite hear. Cardiac is a subclass of the major class. So cardiac is what kind of tissue? It's muscle. Yeah, so is muscle a kind of tissue? Absolutely. And what's the fourth kind? The fourth kind, so we got epithelium, connective tissue, smooth is a kind of muscle. And nervous tissue, okay? Yeah, so that's some good basic recall that you should have. The four general kinds of tissue, epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. All right, and we're going to concentrate on muscle tissue. What is muscle tissue? What is muscle tissue specialized for? Muscle tissue specialized for? Contraction, that's right. It contracts with force. It can develop tension. Okay, and we're going to first look at skeletal muscle. And skeletal muscle, remember, is under voluntary control. Everything else in your body, including cardiac and smooth muscle, is under involuntary control. Okay. And skeletal muscle is voluntary. Skeletal muscle, the only thing in your whole body that is voluntary. Everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system. Okay, well, you know, I'm not going to read this slide to you, but you should certainly be aware of the origin and insertion of a muscle, what the definition for flexion is, and extension, okay? And muscles, the way that you control your body is through an antagonistic mechanism, so you have precise control of your body. Okay, so you have flexor muscles and extensor muscles in opposite body compartments. So for instance, the biceps is for flexion, the triceps is for extension, and the reason why you have precise and controlled balance of your fingertip, Like if that person with a fancy uniform and badge and sidearm asks you some evening to put your fingertip on your nose, right, it's because you have good bicep and tricep antagonistic control. Okay. Arrow options. Okay. All right, in terms of structure of a muscle, you might have to review the basic anatomy of a muscle. So here is a bone. Most muscles interconnect two bones, and when a muscle is stimulated, it's going to contract and it's going to bring these two bones together, usually through a joint or an articulation. And a muscle attaches to a bone via connective tissue we call tendon. That's dense regular connective tissue. So, and that is continuous with connective tissue sheath that surrounds the whole muscle. That's what we call fascia. And there's another connective tissue sheath underneath the fascia that we call the epimysium. And you can see that if we look at a whole muscle, for instance, this might be like what, the brachialis muscle or something. Hard to tell exactly what muscle it is, but that would be a pretty good example. You can see that this whole muscle right here is broken down into compartments, and those compartments sometimes are called bundles or fascicles. And so if we put all these fascicles together and look at the muscle, I want you to appreciate that a muscle really is an organ. What the heck is an organ? What is an organ? I think you were on the right track. What did you say? But you're awfully shy, so I didn't quite hear you. Yeah, so an organ is composed of one or more different kinds of tissues, right? And so this is an organ because it has muscle tissue. And what other kind of tissue does it have? It has connective tissue. And in order for this muscle to work, there's got to be nerves going to it, so it has nervous tissue. And it also has blood, which is another kind of connective tissue. So when I say muscle, I want you to think of an organ that's organized with nervous tissue and connective tissue, as well as muscle tissue. Okay. So the epimysium surrounds the whole muscle, the organ. Right. The fascicles are surrounded by perimysium, and every fascicle is made up of muscle cells. And another name for a muscle cell is a muscle fiber. These are very, very long, cylindrical structures. And the reason why they're very, very long and contain many nuclei is because at one time they were thousands of individual cells that fused together to form this long rod-shaped structure. All right, so they're macroscopically long, but they're still microscopically small in diameter. So you still can't see them, but they're very, very long. And then surrounding every muscle fiber or muscle cell, we have the endomysium. Okay, so you can see the endomysium. So this represents a cell right here. That's this structure right here. So here is the endomysium right here. And even if we pull out a cell, here we can see a couple nuclei. Why does this muscle cell or muscle fiber have a number of nuclei inside of it? Because most cells have how many nuclei? Just one. But here is a cell that has many. Why is that? Because at one time, this muscle fiber was what? Thousands of individual cells that fused together. Okay, that's the reason why. And if we look inside this fiber right here, we see some other cylindrical structures. And these you should think of as organelles inside the cell. These are what we call myofibrils. So these are myofibrils. These are the organelles that provide for contraction. And furthermore, if we look inside a myofibril, we can see some even smaller cylindrical structures. These are proteins inside the myofibrils. We call these myofilaments. So please be aware of how a muscle is built together, the building blocks. So the smallest building blocks that we're going to be looking at are myofilaments. And there are two kinds of myofilaments that you're probably aware of. What are the two kinds of myofilaments? Actin and myosin. And they have different thicknesses. Which one is the thin one? Okay. I'm going to go over that, I guess. The thin one is actin and the thick one is myosin. Right. And probably what I see on this slide right here, I only see like one kind. That's probably the myosin. All right, so this is a myofibril. If we put a bunch of myofibrils together, we get a fiber. If we put a bunch of fibers together, we get a fascicle. If we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get the whole muscle, which is the organ. Okay. Okay. Now, if we look at this muscle cell or muscle fiber one more time, the plasma membrane we call the sarcolemma. So anytime you see this sarco, you should be thinking of skeletal muscle. So sarcolemma means the plasma membrane. Sarcoplasmic reticulum is what we find inside a skeletal muscle. That's a smooth endoplasmic reticulum, but we call it sarcoplasmic reticulum. And the sarcoplasm is the same thing as cytoplasm inside of a muscle cell. All right, so there's a striking characteristic of skeletal muscle, and that is that it has a stripe pattern. So we call these striations. And this is due to the repeated pattern over and over and over again of the actin and myosin myofilaments. So, and again, you can see that a muscle cell is multinucleated and it's just a linear fiber. All right, so the way that a muscle fiber is stimulated is through a special junction. What do we call the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? The structural and functional unit of communication between cells. How about the structural and functional unit of life? What's the structural and functional unit of life? What's the basic building block of life? That's the cell. That's right, that's the cell. So I want you to appreciate that between cells, when cells are communicating with each other, there's a structural and functional unit. And that is called a synapse. Okay? And we looked at a synapse. You might have said synapse, but I can't quite hear past the fans that we got going right here. All right, so remember there are two kinds of synapses. What are the two kinds of synapses? And let me know if I should write this on the board, but this is sort of a review. Okay, there is a chemical synapse, and what's another kind of synapse? Gap junction. That's the structure of it, and a gap junction is an electrical synapse. All right, so chemical synapses use chemicals to transmit information between two cells, but electrical synapses use electrical events to transmit information between two cells. And so the neuromuscular junction right here is a synapse because it's a way for a nerve, a motor neuron, to communicate with a muscle cell. And this particular synapse is not an electrical synapse, it is a chemical synapse. So a chemical synapse needs what to go across the synapse? A neurotransmitter, right. And all neuromuscular junctions, a neuromuscular junction is what we find in skeletal muscle, use the same neurotransmitter. And when we talked about autonomic nervous system, we talked a little bit about the somatic motor pathway and the transmitter that's used and even the receptor type down over here. Okay. Does anybody remember what the neurotransmitter that's used at the specifically the neuromuscular junction? That is the, that's a receptor, but the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. So this is a cholinergic fiber right here. And the receptor has got to be an acetylcholine receptor. And you know a couple different kinds of acetylcholine receptors. Does anybody remember which one? Maybe I didn't say. This is a nicotinic. This is a nicotinic receptor. So it needs to bind to acetylcholines, and when it does, what happens? What does a nicotinic receptor look like? Ooh, I think you had to draw this out on the last test in your mind. Is it a channel, or is it a G protein coupled type receptor that changes metabolism? It's a channel, right? So when two molecules of acetylcholine bind to that cholinergic receptor or a nicotinic receptor, it just opens up a channel for sodium. And on the outside of the cell, sodium is high. When that channel opens up, sodium can diffuse inside the cell. And what's the big deal about that? What does that cause? Depolarization. A significant electrical event for the cell. All right, because that can stimulate action potentials. And every time a nerve impulse comes down this motor neuron, okay, there are so many synaptic vesicles and so many nicotinic receptors, and you can see the branching pattern on this axon terminus right here. that depolarization, the resultant depolarization at the neuromuscular junction, is always going to reach threshold and cause an action potential on the surface of this muscle cell. So you can see that a muscle cell is sort of like a neuron because it can transmit action potentials, but the big difference is that the muscle can contract when that happens. So we're going to look at that process today. Okay, so this is the neuromuscular junction. You can see that it's loaded with mitochondria, and that this axon terminus actually inserts into the surface of the muscle cell. Okay, there are some additional junctional complexes between the axon terminus and the muscle cell, because unlike when the presynaptic neuron stimulates a postsynaptic neuron, the neurons don't hop around. But when this motor neuron stimulates this muscle cell, what's the muscle going to do? Yeah, it's going to hop around. It's going to move, right? And it could move away from this motor neuron right here. So this is the biggest difference between a regular synapse between two neurons and the neuromuscular junction, is that these axon terminus right here are more fixed in position. They're more glued in position because of their structure, so that when the muscle contracts, it doesn't pull away from the innervation of that muscle, because then you'd lose control of that muscle if it were to rip away. Okay, so it's loaded with nicotinic receptors, which always cause an action potential on this nerve and on this muscle fiber. Okay, so let's see if there's anything else I want to see. Here you can see just a nice micrograph of an axon coming down with a neuromuscular junction, and I could probably see three different muscle cells right here that receive three different branches from that single motor neuron. So when there's an action potential in this neuron, it's going to cause this muscle to contract, or this muscle fiber, and this muscle fiber, and this muscle fiber to contract. And the way that a muscle fiber contracts is like an action potential. It's an all or none response. Once that action potential gets set up, it flows over the whole muscle cell and causes the whole muscle cell or fiber to contract with whatever force that it can generate. Okay, so this specialization of the surface of the muscle cell, right, that grabs onto the axon, is called the motor end plate. And not only does it have ligand-gated channels, it also has voltage-gated channels on it. That's kind of a difference between nerve cells, because in a nerve cell, where do you first see voltage-gated channels? You see them on dendrites. Yeah, because dendrites have a lot of synapses, but a dendrite doesn't have voltage-gated channels. It's all the way down at the axon hillock, right? So a nerve cell does different things. It can integrate information. It receives EPSPs and IPSPs, and it integrates that information up at the axon hillock. But a muscle cell only sees EPSPs produced by acetylcholine, and a muscle cell can never make up its mind if it's going to produce an action potential. It always produces an action potential, which produces contraction. Okay. The motor end plate is this area right here underneath the synaptic cleft. Okay. So a neuron can make a decision as to whether or not it's going to pass on an action potential, but a muscle can't, because if you want to pick up a pencil and you give information to that muscle contract, you don't want that muscle ever to make up its own mind and say, no, I don't want to pick up that cup of coffee or whatever, right? It just follows commands from the motor cortex in the brain. All right, so you've maybe run into this concept in lab, and that is the concept of a motor unit. So a motor unit consists of a single somatic motor neuron, and you can see it branching. In this example, it branches into three branches, and it can stimulate three neuromuscular junctions on three different skeletal muscle fibers. So what the heck is a muscle fiber again? It's a cell, right? It's an individual cell, right? And again, these muscle fibers can never decide whether they're going to contract or not contract. When there's an action potential on this motor neuron, these three fibers are going to contract with whatever force they can generate, maximally. It's an all or none response. Okay, so the motor unit in this case is one motor neuron and these three individual muscle cells right here. Here we have a different motor neuron, a motor unit. It's a single motor neuron, but now how many muscle fibers are going to be stimulated into contracting when there is an action potential on this motor neuron? It's about 10, if you count these axon terminals right here. It's about 10 different muscle fibers. So we could ask, which motor unit is going to produce a stronger contraction? Is it going to be the first one we talked about, or the second one that has more muscle fibers contracting when an action potential goes down this motor unit? The second one, right? So if there is a motor unit with three individual fibers being told to contract versus a motor unit that has 30 neuromuscular junctions, meaning 30 different individual muscle cells, right, then the motor unit that has 30 muscle cells attached to it is going to produce, what, 10 times the force of contraction. And as a matter of fact, that's how a muscle, like what we're looking here in the organ, can grade contractions. An individual muscle fiber cannot grade the force of contraction, but a muscle, the organ, can grade contraction, means you can produce a weak contraction for lifting something that's very light, or a strong contraction for lifting something very heavy by recruiting different motor units to provide for the proper kind of force. All right, so when a motor neuron is activated, all muscle fibers in that motor unit contract as a unit. The number of motor fibers in a motor unit varies according to the degree of fine control and capability of the muscle. We call that the innervation ratio. And the innervation ratio is the number of motor neurons to muscle fibers, and that varies from 1 to 100 in areas where you have good discriminative control, fine control over muscle contraction, like facial muscles for articulation, breathing, eating, muscles in your hands where you have very fine control, compared to innervation ratios of 1 to 2,000 in parts of your body that you don't use very much in terms of controlling your body, like postural muscles in your back. All right, so fine control occurs when motor units are small. One motor neuron innervates just a small number of muscle fibers. Okay, so since individual motor units fire, or individual muscle cells fire in an all or none response, how do skeletal muscles perform smooth movements depending on what kind of weight is lifted? So if I'm going to lift up something very light compared to, like for instance, this pen right here, then our brain figures out, well, it looks at that pen and says, gets an impression, well, that's a very light object, and so I'm going to stimulate just a few muscles in your biceps. So those few muscles are going to contract to their full degree, but there's only going to be a few of them. But for instance, if it was a gallon of milk or something that's relatively heavy, and you look at that gallon of milk, it looks relatively heavy, your mind automatically then sends signals out to not just a few motor units, but many motor units, and each of those muscle fibers contract to their maximal capability, and you can lift that heavy weight. So we call that recruitment. When you enlist more and more motor units or motor fibers to contract, that produces a stronger force of contraction to lift heavier and heavier objects, we call that recruitment. So the brain estimates the number of motor units required and stimulates them to contract. But that doesn't always work necessarily, because maybe, and I think maybe I've mentioned this before, there might be a time when you were out someplace at a restaurant and everybody asked for water, and they brought water over in these big tumblers, okay, that to you kind of look like glass, and it's filled with water and ice cubes, or mugs, all right? And you reach for that mug and you pick it up, and then all of a sudden it starts moving real fast. Because why? You had information because you thought it was glass, but it turned out to be plastic, which is what? Really light, right? So what happens? Oh, right away you realize you're moving your arm way too fast, and you catch it before you throw that mug of water on whoever you're having dinner with, okay? So your brain does estimate, but it very quickly can adjust the number of motor units for the proper movement. All right, so more and larger motor units are activated to produce greater strength. We call that recruitment. All right, so here is just a single cell. What do we call a single cell again? A fiber. All right, and the contractile organelle inside a fiber is called a, the structure right here. This is a myofibril. And myofibrils are made up of myofilaments. And you know this is a fiber because I can see I can see many, many nuclei inside the cell. The other thing that you would expect to see inside the cell would be mitochondria all over the place because contraction is going to require ATP. Okay, and notice you see that striped pattern again, a repeating pattern over and over again. Here's a very light band, here's a dark band, here's a light band, another dark band, and this repeats from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. There's a special little narrow dark line right here and right here. Between these two special little narrow dark lines, this is what we call the sarcomere. Okay? And these little narrow dark lines are what we call the Z lines or Z discs. And what letter of the alphabet is Z? That's the last one. Okay, just seeing who's still awake. Well, that just means that this is the end point of a sarcomere, which also means it's the beginning of the next one. Right? So that just means it's the end point of a sarcomere. So here is the end point of this sarcomere, but it means also that it's the beginning of this one. So here is the end point of this sarcomere, but that means that's the beginning of the next one, down to over here. And so sarcomeres line up from one end of the muscle fiber to the other, and as a matter of fact, these sarcomeres line up between neighboring myofibrils as well. And so no matter how you look at the muscle, it looks striated. Inside a myofibril, you got two kinds of filaments again. You got the thick and the thin, called thick is myosin, thin is the actin. Okay. So when we look at these bands, we see a dark band right here and a light band. The dark band is what we call the A band, and the light band is what we call the I band. And you've got to probably remember that, because we're going to talk about what changes, what are the changes in these bands when a muscle contracts. So you got to be familiar with these things. Okay, so how are you going to remember that the A represents the dark band and I the light band? Because there's an A in dark and there is an I in light. That's the easiest way to memorize it. But that's not how it was named at the beginning. Okay. Somebody named it this way because of how muscle affects polarized light. And I don't think you have to know that. Okay, just remember, the A band is the dark band and the I band is the light band. So if we have a nice illustration of what a sarcomere looks like, remember a sarcomere goes from a Z disc to a Z disc or a Z line to Z line. If it just one-dimensional depiction right here, you could call that a Z-line. But remember, a myofibril is what? A tubular structure. And that Z-line is really what? Like a plate or a disc across the myofibril. All right, so the dark band is where we have the thick filament. So it blocks a lot of light. So this is the A-band right here. And the light band are places within a sarcomere where we don't have myosin. So it doesn't absorb as much light. So that's part of the light band. Right, so the I band contains thin filaments, the A band contains myosin. Some other little things that we see is that in the center of the sarcomere, okay, there is an H zone, which kind of looks like an intermediate kind of darkness. Right, it's not quite light, not quite dark, because it does contain myosin, but there's no overlap. You don't see any actin in this region. And this, the places where myosin is fixed, right in the middle of the sarcomere, you see these little dots right here? This is sometimes what we call the M-line. So what the heck is the M-line? That stands for middle. Okay, middle line. So that's not hard to remember either. All right, so that's some parts. We see an I-band. Right, I-band goes from here to wherever the myosin begins in the next sarcomere, and the A-band is just this myosin filament. So this is just a little bit different depiction of it. Again, this is a view from the side. The illustration on the bottom right here is a more of a three-dimensional view of actin and myosin within a myofibril. So remember, a myofibril is a tube structure filled with actin and myosin. And if we look on the edge of a myofibril, okay, on end, so we're looking down a length of a myofibril right here, we see thick filaments represented by these dark dots and thick dots, that's myosin. And then what is surrounding every myosin molecule? Can you see these little thin dots on the screen? I can see it on my monitor. I don't know if you can see them on the screen.
Yeah,
you can see them. Actually, I can see them better on the screen. All right, what do you think those little thin dots are? That's the actin molecules. So surrounding every myosin is an array of actin molecules. And if you look at an actin molecule like this one right here, what's surrounding every actin? There's a myosin here and a myosin here. All right, so they surround each other. That's going to play an important role in how muscle contracts. Okay, so from Z-line to Z-line, or Z-disc to Z-disc, what do we call that structure? It's a repeating structure that goes from one end of the muscle to the other. That is the sarcomere. And so we talked about structural and functional unit of life is a cell. Structural and functional unit of communication between two cells is a synapse. Well, the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle is the sarcomere. So if you know how a sarcomere shortens, or how these Z discs are brought together to make the sarcomere shorter, you know almost everything there is to know about muscle contraction. Right? So if you know how this one little unit works, you know how that whole muscle fiber works. As a matter of fact, how the whole muscle, the organ works. Okay, so here's that M line again. All right, so here is that thick filament, which is myosin. There are some head groups that stick off of the myosin molecule that almost poke up and touch the actin, but not quite. Notice that the actin are fixed to the Z-discs. All right, so they can't float around. They're fixed to the Z-discs. And the myosin molecule, in this case right here in the middle, is fixed to the M-line, but it's also fixed by a couple other little proteins. These are called titin molecules, and you can see that it looks like a spring. Yeah, it looks like a little coil spring right there that is also holding the myosin in the correct position. All right, so the job, what's the job of skeletal muscle again? Primary function is to contract, right? So something's got to shorten inside of a muscle for contraction to take place. And you know, three proteins that make up this sarcomere. Okay, so I got to ask you, which one of these proteins actually shortens when the sarcomere shortens? Is it the actin, myosin, okay, or this titin filament? And what I mean, just not shorten, but actually pull with force so that you can generate tension. Well, you probably are taking this class because you don't know that kind of stuff, right? So we need to go over that. So which one of these proteins actually shortens? Okay, and here are the three possible kinds, the titin, the actin, and the myosin. Okay. Well, I'm going to tell you it's not the titin right now, okay? And what does that titin do? One of the properties that you of muscle that you learned about in anatomy is that it is excitable, it contracts, but it also does something else. It can stretch. Yeah, it can stretch. It's extensible. And another property that goes along with extensibility, meaning that it can stretch, that when after it stretches, what can it do? It can go back to its original position. We call that elasticity, right? So for instance, when the biceps contracts, there's a muscle that has to stretch to allow that. What muscle has to stretch? The triceps, yeah, the antagonistic muscle. And then when the biceps relaxes, what happens to the triceps? It goes back to its original length because of elasticity provided by these titin filaments. All right, so the titin is important for elasticity, but it can't really generate force. It just brings the muscle back to its original location. All right, so it does change length, but not with force. So that leaves actin and myosin to know something about. So let's see how the sarcomere actually shortens. Okay, so muscles contract because myofibrils get shorter, and that's a myofibril is just what? Thousands of sarcomeres lined up from end to end. Because thin filaments slide over in between the thick filaments toward the center. shortening the distance from Z-disc to Z-disc. So you might have to read over this a couple of times after we describe what's going on. All right, so here, let's look at the illustration, maybe not the micrographs on the top, but let's look at the illustrations down on the bottom. So don't forget, a sarcomere goes from Z to Z. So I see two sarcomeres here. In the next line, I see two sarcomeres. And the next line, I see two sarcomeres. And what is your overall impression? Is the length of these two sarcomeres the same? Or are they getting closer together? Or are they getting shorter? They're getting shorter. So this actually depicts what? Contraction of a muscle due to what's happening inside a sarcomere. All right, so the A band just represents the length of this myosin molecule. And the I band is what? It goes wherever there is not a myosin molecule. Okay. And case number 2 over here shows partial contraction. Case number 3 shows a fully contracted muscle fiber, or at least what the sarcomere looks like. All right, so I'm going to come up to the board. Let's look at a couple things. From the resting state compared to the contracted state, there is a band that disappears. What band disappears? Well, the Z is here, here, and here. Okay, so that's still there. Okay, look at this I band right here, which doesn't have any myosin in it. It gets smaller when the muscle is partially contracted, and when it's fully contracted, right, it really almost totally disappears. So that I band disappears. What about the A band? Does the A band disappear? Oh, I see it here, and I see it here. Okay, so when somebody asks you a question, what bands disappear in the muscle? It's the I band that disappears, and then this H zone also gets smaller and smaller and smaller, right? The H gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, how on earth can that happen? Let's look at, so we're thinking about, well, what muscle protein actually gets shorter? Let's start with myosin, okay? So here is myosin, and look, it's almost the length of this pen. Not quite. I guess I could get a ruler out. Is there a ruler handy? You got one? Oh, yeah, there's one. Yeah, well, why not? Why not use a ruler? Let's see how well they made the textbook. Eesh. Hopefully it will correspond to what I want to show you. All right, so here is the length of a myosin protein at rest, which is what? Put it up here. And I'm just going to put it right here. That looks pretty good. Now let's go to a partially contracted state. What is the length of that myosin? That's the same. Well, we might not have enough resolution to see a difference. Let's go to the fully contracted state to see if the myosin changes. Does the myosin change length? Did the myosin change length? Did it get shorter at all? From here to here? Did it get longer? It stays the same length. Okay, so you can't say that a sarcomere shortens because the myosin shortens. All right? Can you kind of see that?
Yeah.
Yeah, good enough? Okay, so the myosin doesn't change. What else can change length to make the sarcomere shorter? Let's look at the actin molecule. That's our last hope that we're going to see what's going on. All right, so here is the length of an actin. I'm going to put the ruler here and here. And let's just go to the fully contracted state to see the maximal deviation possible. So I put the end of the ruler there, and look where my thumb is. What about actin? It stays what? The same length as well. So if I were to ask you that question, what protein inside the sarcomere shortens when this, are these sarcomeres actually getting shorter? Well, what do you mean no? Here's Z-line, and here's a Z-line. And over here, that's definitely shorter. So the sarcomere gets shorter, but the myosin doesn't get shorter. The actin doesn't get shorter. Right? So if I ask you that question, what protein inside the sarcomere gets shorter when the sarcomere gets shorter, you would have to say, well, there isn't one that gets shorter. So we now have to know, why does the sarcomere get shorter? How is it possible?
So the myosin and the actin doesn't get shorter.
It stays the same length. Okay, the sarcomere shortens, but these proteins stay the same length. How is that possible? Well, when the muscle gets activated in just the right way, okay, so here we have, let's just say here we have a couple proteins, a myosin and an actin. At rest, they're interdigitated, they're overlapped a little bit. All right, so what would be the total length of these two markers? It goes from here to here. But when a muscle contracts, the filaments, the individual filaments stay the same length, they only slide over each other. Okay, and now let's look at the length of that sarcomere. Now it's much shorter. It's from here to here, but what can you tell me about the length of these two markers? Hasn't changed at all. They're the same length. They only slide over each other. So that's the model we use in our mind to describe contraction in skeletal muscle. As a matter of fact, most things that contract, that's called the, oh, it's on the slide right there, sliding filament model. Okay, so we explain, and we have good evidence, this is a theory, backed up by a lot of scientific evidence, that when a sarcomere contracts, it contracts not because proteins contract, but proteins only do what? They slide past each other. Okay, and that's going to be really important when we look at some effects of muscle. Now, you do have to understand something else about muscle. How is it that they slide over each other? Okay, so here is just a little synopsis of the sliding filament theory of contraction. All right, I'm not going to read that to you, but you can read. We talked about all those things already. So let's look at even some more microscopic detail of the actin and myosin. So we're zooming way in to a molecular level of this sarcomere, and we're only going to look at actin and myosin. So this thick filament right here is the that's myosin, and this thin filament is the actin, right? And we saw before that the myosin filaments have these head groups poking up off of them like this, and they're trying to reach up and touch the actin molecule. But we see some other components on these proteins. Okay, so these blue dots, how did I do, blue?
Purple.
Yeah, okay. So these purple dots right here are the little subunits that make up actin. All right, so this is globular actin units that get put together, and if we put a bunch together, it forms a filament. Okay, also on actin, we see something called troponin. And a third component that we see on an actin filament is tropomyosin. Okay, troponin is very similar to a kind of compound that we looked at already that controls a certain part of glycogenolysis. Okay, it's a cousin molecule to another molecule that attracts calcium. Can you remember the name of a molecule that attracts calcium that's a regulatory protein? Calmodulin, for instance. So troponin and calmodulin are very similar in their nature. So troponin is going to regulate the activity of this muscle cell when it binds calcium. Tropomyosin, right over here, is a big, long, filamentous molecule. Right, so that's how I remember which one is troponin and which one is tropomyosin, because troponin is short, the word is short, tropomyosin is a big long word, and that also corresponds to this big long protein. Okay, so that's enough for actin at the moment. Let's go and talk about the myosin. All right, so here is the part of the myosin molecule. All right, this is what we call a cross bridge. And it can reach up and grab a hold of actin. This is a myosin tail. This is the myosin head group. And the head group on a myosin contains a couple active sites. One of the active sites can bind ATP. So ATP can fit in this little groove in the head group. And there's another binding spot. This is what we call the actin binding site. The actin binding site, if the conditions are right, can reach up and bind to each one of these G-actins right here. So on the G-actin, there is also an active site. Let's see if I can focus this a little bit better. Ooh, that's about it. Okay. All right, but when So this ATP can be used as an energy source to change the conformation of this cross bridge. All right, so notice it's kind of a subtle difference. All right, notice that in this case, it's what? Crooked. But in this case over here, it is what? It's straight. So this cross bridge can cycle between these two conditions like this. All right, but that's not an endothermic reaction, that's exothermic, so it needs an energy source, namely ATP, in order to cycle from one of these states to the other. All right, so ATP is necessary for this reaction. So you hydrolyze ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate to get that conformation change. Okay, so that's one part that we need to look at. Okay, the power stroke is what's used, okay, to exert force between a myosin and an actin. And so the power stroke doesn't occur when ATP is hydrolyzed. The power stroke is when the head group, okay, articulates, or you could actually think of it as like a flexion, right, of this cross bridge. And that happens when inorganic phosphate is released from the ATP binding site. So this is what we call the power stroke. All right, so now how is it that the filaments slide over each other? When the signals are proper, this binding site on myosin can attach itself to a binding site on actin. Okay, so let's pretend my hand is an actin molecule. If the signal is proper, I probably want to go like this to see if I can figure out the model it, just like you see it on the slide. Okay, when the muscle is signaled to contract, the straight head group or cross bridge on myosin can reach up and grab onto actin. And if there's ATP, all right, and it's hydrolyzed, then this cross bridge is straight. It attaches to an actin, and when inorganic phosphate is released from the head group, guess what happens to the cross bridge? It bends. Okay, so when it bends, what happens to my hand? It slides. Okay, and then this is going to repeat itself. All right, so ATP is going to, okay, cause the release of the head group. It's going to hydrolyze. It's going to straighten out again, reach up and grab actin at another active site, and the power stroke, when PI, inorganic phosphate, is released, is going to cause the cross bridge to flex again, which is going to release, reach up again, and keep moving, okay, keep the actin and myosin sliding over each other. Okay, so it's not just one cross bridge, it's what, thousands of cross bridges, but don't forget, surrounding every actin is what? A number of myosin. So the actin is completely surrounded by myosin, and there are thousands of cross bridges all cycling and working together, pulling the Z disks closer together toward the M line. Okay, so you have a pretty good picture in your book that shows this. So a resting fiber, the cross bridge is not attached to the actin. Okay, but it's in the straight configuration, so that means that it has used the energy in ATP. It's been hydrolyzed, so we have ADP and inorganic phosphate. All right, with the proper signal, right, and we're going to talk about that proper signal in just a little bit, the head group can reach up and grab that actin molecule, so here we have it right here. All right, the cross bridges bind, and then when inorganic phosphate is released, then it puts a bend in this cross bridge. It bends, and what happens? Actin and myosin slide past each other. All right, so it also releases ADP. So now we have the ATP binding site empty. Another ATP can bind. And when ATP binds to the head group, that's when it dissociates from the actin molecule. All right, so when ATP, so here I don't see it binding ATP. ATP comes in, and when it does, look at the association between the actin and myosin. It's released. So I think this is interesting because when the filaments slide past each other, that's not when ATP is necessary. ATP is necessary to do what? To unlatch the actin and myosin. Okay, causes the dissociation. And then after that dissociation, when ATP is hydrolyzed, then the myosin extends once again. Right? And then after that, it can bind to actin. So this is what we call the power stroke. That's not hydrolysis of ATP. That's when inorganic phosphate is released. The binding of ATP actually causes the dissociation of actin and myosin. And this explains kind of a paradoxical situation that we see in people that die. Because what kind of condition are muscles in when somebody that recently dies, not 12 hours or 24 hours or 2 days after their death, but immediately after their death, what happens to their muscles? Yeah, they go into rigor mortis. They start to contract. And so people for a long time were kind of confused. Well, as ATP isn't being produced and gets used up in the cell, how come people's muscles actually contract? Because you would think you need energy for contraction. The reason is, in order for muscles to relax, right, that's what you need ATP for. So when a dead person's muscles run out of ATP, the myosin and actin stick together, and because there's no ATP, they can't dissociate. Right? So it goes into that condition of rigor, and that stays, those muscles stay in that condition until these muscle proteins actually start to degrade. That all depends, you know, on the temperature and everything else of those particular muscles. All right, so this model does explain a lot of interesting kinds of phenomena. All right, so this is what we call cross-bridge cycling. It requires ATP, okay, to cause this articulation to take place and the dissociation of the myosin cross-bridge with the actin molecule. But now let's see how contraction is controlled and what is the controlling signal inside the muscle cell or even the myofibril. Okay, so control of contraction. What's controlling when myosin can actually grab hold of actin? Okay, so here is that actin molecule again, and here's a troponin complex, and here's a big long tropomyosin molecule. Okay, and when the muscle is at rest, the active sites where myosin binds to actin is covered up. It's in this area here, and this area here, and it's going to be in this area here. So when the muscle is at rest, the tropomyosin blocks the active site so myosin can't grab to it. So when the muscle is told to contract, the myosin head group is going to grab onto this actin right here. But it can't in the resting state because tropomyosin is in the way. There's no place where it can grab. Or here, or it's going to grab here. But it can't because tropomyosin is in the way. So in order for muscle to contract, or in order for actin and myosin to slide past each other, we have to do something with this tropomyosin. We got to move it out of the way. So let's see how that happens. Okay, that is due to calcium. So what really is happening here? Okay, so here's myosin, here's the cross bridge, and here is the tropomyosin, right? Here's the troponin, and can you see that little dimple right there and right there and right there? That's the binding site for the head group. But can this actin binding site bind to actin because tropomyosin is in the way? Okay, all right, so here is troponin. We said troponin was similar to calmodulin that binds calcium, right? So when cytosolic calcium levels increase, calcium binds to troponin, and when it does, it causes a conformation change in the tropomyosin. And look what happens to tropomyosin when troponin binds calcium. It gets out of the way. So now these binding sites are available for this head group. And so now myosin can bind actin, and if there's ATP present, right, it can go through that full cross-bridge cycling, and the filaments can slide past each other. but there has to be this calcium signal inside the cell. So that's the last part of what we have to look at, is how this calcium gets released inside the muscle cell to allow sliding of the myofilaments. And guess what happens when the calcium levels decrease? As the calcium levels decrease, okay, the troponin calcium complex dissociates, and when it dissociates, the tropomyosin goes back, covering up the binding sites on myosin, and then the filaments can't slide past each other anymore. Right, so they can only slide past when calcium levels are high inside the cell. Okay, well, you also learned all this stuff in anatomy. We're still looking at just a single muscle fiber. Oh, we're almost done for today, but not quite. Okay. Huh? 10 more minutes. Okay, so here is the sarcolemma, that's the cell membrane. All right, these are the myofibrils, so we're not looking at a muscle of the organ, we're looking at a muscle fiber, and these are all myofibrils, and you can see actin and myosin inside these myofibrils right here. Okay, oops, I hope it's okay. And we can see a bunch of holes in the membrane. Now we said that a muscle fiber acts like a nerve fiber, because it can conduct action potentials over the cell membrane, just like a nerve fiber can. Okay? And when an action potential slides over one of these holes right here, it actually goes down into the hole, into this tubule that is transverse to the long length of the muscle cell. So we call these transverse tubules. So a T-tubule or a transverse tubule is a way for action potentials to actually do what? Go through the whole cell, be transmitted through the whole cell. So when an action potential is coming down from this direction, it continues down the muscle cell, but it also deviates, it takes this little side trip, right? It just flows over the whole cell on the inside and the outside of the cell. And this structure right here is what we call the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Sarcoplasmic reticulum is just a fancy name for smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And in a muscle cell, smooth endoplasmic reticulum is not primarily there for lipid synthesis, but it is there for another function. Can anybody remember the other function? Calcium storage. It's a reservoir for calcium. So there are calcium ATP pumps that are always pumping calcium from within the myofibril into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So there's very high concentration of calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Right, and there are special places of the sarcoplasmic reticulum right along the T-tubule, which we call terminal cisternae. So there's a big, like a big pillow filled with calcium here, and on the other side of the T-tubule, right here. So when an action potential comes down the T-tubule, it's going to stimulate the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then calcium will diffuse through the whole myofibril. It's going to bind to troponin, it's going to move tropomyosin out of the way, and the filaments are going to slide past each other. That's going to produce muscle contraction due to that calcium signal. So it starts with what? An action potential moving down the T-tubule. That's going to cause release of calcium. Okay, and when that action potential goes away, the calcium is going to be pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum because those pumps are working all the time. And when there's no action potential and calcium is put back in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it comes off of the troponin, and tropomyosin covers up the binding sites again, and muscle contraction stops. Okay. So, I don't know if this is an exam figure, but in anatomy you had to know all this a lot. Okay. So here is the last slide. We see a neuromuscular junction right here, and there are nicotinic receptors that cause massive depolarizations in the sarcolemma, and then there are voltage-gated channels here and here. These are always going to reach threshold because these polarizations from acetylcholine are huge. It always reaches threshold, which sets up what? An action potential flows over the whole sarcolemma down into the T-tubules, and There are voltage-gated channels and also mechanical channels, mechanically gated channels. So when these proteins change conformation, they pull on channels on the sarcoplasmic reticulum that open up these channels so that calcium are going to move out. And why is it that calcium moves out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum? What's the force?
Is it because high concentration?
It's from high concentration to low concentration. Because calcium pumps are always taking calcium from the sarcoplasm, okay, and putting it into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And so when these channels open up, then calcium just rushes out because there's a huge concentration difference. And these channels for calcium are 10 times bigger than the sodium channels that you're used to dealing with in terms of action potentials on the cell membrane of either a muscle cell or a nerve cell. So that calcium then acts as a signal for the sliding of these filaments past each other. So this is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. So you can see that it's a lot of individual events. So in lab, you had to come up, this is the last thing for tonight, and I'm going to start with this figure next time, so remind me to start with this figure again next time. You saw, okay, on your computer screen, okay, a couple graphs. You saw this one right here, voltage versus time. And over here you had tension of, this is an N, tension of a muscle fiber versus time. And you could set the rate of the stimulus on a muscle, right? And so you could stimulate a muscle to produce an action potential like that. But when did tension develop in that muscle? So voltage is different than tension, right? Voltage is just due to those electrical currents, but tension is really what? That's when the muscle starts to contract and starts to pull on that transducer, the imaginary transducer. So does tension in a muscle happen at the same time as the action potential? Does it precede the action potential? Or does it happen afterwards? Right, maybe you guys could remember this, but remember, the muscle is relaxed, action potential comes along, and then a muscle contracts. So here's peak contraction, here's the peak voltage. Does that happen at the same time? No, at much different time. Right, so this period from the time of excitation to when the muscle begins to contract, right, is this period right here, and this is what we call what? The latent period. So here's the signal, and then sometime after that the muscle starts to contract. And why is there that delay? Because the action potential has to flow over the cell. It's got to open up these calcium channels. Calcium has to diffuse into the myofibril. And when it diffuses into the myofibril, it's got to bind to troponin, which then causes tropomyosin to get out of the way, which then allows the myosin head group to bind to actin. And that whole process takes time. So it takes time. So that produces that latent period. All right, so we're going to see that for the heart as well. That electrical activity of the heart is just a signal for contraction. It's not the actual contraction that's taking place on the heart, which is what, a mechanical event. There's something that has to couple mechanical events with the electrical events. So we call that the latent period. Probably mostly due to diffusion of calcium. That's probably the slowest part of excitation-contraction coupling. Okay, so read over this stuff. Here's a nice little flow chart of how that all happens. So maybe I'll start there next time. Muscle relaxation, we talked about that already. Okay. Okay, so that's it for this evening. Unless you guys want to have lab.
Sure.
Sure, yeah.